from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. An estimated 300,000 to 400,000 people gathered in the streets of New York City Sunday to show the world they care about climate change. Daniel Dickinson was there and filed this report.
The message from the streets of New York City this Sunday was that action on climate change is needed now. The organizers say that more than 300,000 people from all walks of life joined the march. They created a noisy carnival atmosphere as they marched through the city. Many were dressed in costumes associated with indigenous groups. Others wore protest t-shirts. Many chanted slogans. Others played music. I asked some of the marchers why they'd come.
I'm here with my union. We're here to support global change for a healthy economy and a healthy environment.
I want the whole world to know that we mean business.
Because the world matters.
Climate change affects all of us, right? There's no other place to live than Mother Earth.
Similar climate events have been reported in 2,000 locations around the world. Rikin Patel is the executive director of the march organizers, Avaaz. He says it's crucial for people to get out onto the streets.
It's important because there's a huge gap between the action that our survival requires on climate change and the action our governments are currently willing to take. And the street is where we close that gap.
The People's Climate March is campaigning for curbs on harmful carbon emissions, which contribute to global warming. Rikin Patel says progress is being made, but that more is needed.
The question is, will it be enough in the race against time we've got? I mean, we're rushing headlong into catastrophic tipping points in our climate system, and we need action fast to transition to a 100% clean energy economy. I think this is the beginning, and it's a lot to build on.
The UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon joined the march with the New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio, as well as the French Sustainable Development Minister Ségolène Royal. Mr. Ban is convening a meeting of heads of state and government at the United Nations on Tuesday to galvanize action on climate change. He says those leaders should listen to what people on this march have to say.
I hope this voice will be truly reflected to the leaders when they meet on September 23rd. Climate change is a defining issue of our time, and there is no time to lose. If we do not take action now, we will have to pay much more.
It's expected that governments from around the world will come to Tuesday's summit with concrete initiatives, and that it will provide significant momentum for a global agreement on tackling climate change. It's hoped a deal will be reached in Paris, France, next year. Daniel Dickinson at the People's Climate March in New York.
Politicians, celebrities, and activists flooded the west side of Manhattan, along with ordinary, everyday people. Among them was Nick Sekrin, who leads the sustainable development team at the UN's development program. He said he joined the march to voice his opinion that there are solutions to effectively deal with climate change. Stephanie Kutrix spoke with him about UNDP's activities and why he felt it was important to be part of one of the largest climate events in history.
Well, we're playing a big role this week at the climate summit. UNDP is leading work on forest action, and there's going to be some exciting announcements in terms of commitments by countries, by companies, by citizens to reduce emissions from forest loss. So we're heavily engaged already and really had to be part of this. I mean, it's so exciting to be here, over 100,000 people probably, and there's so much energy here, and it's sending the very clear message to the world, we care.
So can you tell us a little bit about what you're seeing around us right now? I mean, it's crowded, we're in the streets of New York City. This is apparently the first climate event in New York City of this magnitude.
Wow, there's so much energy here. I mean, there's a helicopter flying over our heads at the moment. I mean, people are in good mood and good spirits. There's a sense of hope. You know, we can do something. You know, we can deal with climate change.
And what are your expectations for Tuesday's climate summit?
Well, we're hoping to get big commitments. I don't think that we're going to solve the climate change problem on Tuesday, but certainly every commitment counts, and some big companies are standing up to the plate, and just listen to that. Just listen to the people talk. It's amazing.
One interesting piece of news was released in the aftermath of the march. According to the New York Times, the family of John D. Rockefeller whose legendary wealth was built on oil, apparently plans to rid its $860 million philanthropic arm of investments in fossil fuels. Quite a number of politicians were there, including former Vice President Al Gore, well known for his movie about climate change, but also the second generation in his family after his father in the U.S. Senate that had Occidental Petroleum as a primary sponsor. Also present, though, were some politicians who are actual environmental activists, among them Howie Hawkins, the Green Party's candidate for governor of New York this year.
We're running here in New York. Our gross domestic product would rank us about 12th in the world. New York can show the nation and the world how to go to clean energy. We can go 100% clean energy in 15 years. We got a study, peer-reviewed scientists, economists, engineers, Cornell, Stanford, say if technology is commercially available, it's economically and technically feasible. It will create 4.5 million jobs. It's a full employment program. It will cut electric costs in half. You hear me? Half. That's why the IOUs, the investor-owned utilities, and the ExxonMobils, and these people that's ripping us off, don't like it. They can't meter the sun. The sun shines, the wind blows, the waves lap at our shore, the earth is warm, we can heat, cool, and power ourselves with energy that's all around us. All we gotta do is build the infrastructure for it, you understand?
Hawkins' running mate, Green Party candidate for New York Lieutenant Governor Brian Jones, was also there.
The governor of New York State has taken millions from the fossil fuel industry. He is deeply invested in pulling carbon up out of the ground and releasing it into our atmosphere, and that means death for all of us. I hate to say it, people, but the Democratic and Republican parties are both deeply committed to pulling more and more carbon up out of the ground and releasing it into our atmosphere. That's why we have to have our own politics. I want to make one last point, and that is this. That climate justice is inextricably linked to social justice. We are not going to save this planet rolling over the bones of working people. We're only going to save this planet by giving people clean, good jobs. We are not going to save this planet rolling over public housing, rolling over the poor and the desperate. We are only going to save this planet by lifting people up. I'm all for what people are doing to try to find local solutions. There are little things that they're doing in their area. I'm all for it, with more power to you. But we cannot solve this locally. The biggest consumer of petroleum on the planet is the U.S. military. There's no local solution for that. We have to abolish the U.S. military. And it's not every day that somebody running for executive office is going to tell you that.
The actions on the streets of New York are continuing. Hundreds of demonstrators marched late Monday morning from Battery Park to Wall Street to protest the role that Wall Street plays in financing practices which cause climate change. We'll have more from the ongoing actions in New York and elsewhere later in the week. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov issued a warning to the United States about the intentions of the latter towards Syria, saying that violation of Syria's sovereignty would be a violation of international law. We have this report from Press TV.
The Russian foreign minister has told his American counterpart that Washington should respect Syria's territorial integrity in its campaign against ISIL there. Sergei Lavrov said in a statement that Syria's sovereignty must be respected unconditionally. He also stressed the need for strict compliance with the UN Charter and norms of international law during action by the US-led coalition, which includes the use of force. Earlier in the day, the Syrian parliament speaker also urged Washington to work with Damascus instead of forming alliances with countries that support the terrorist organization. U.S. President Barack Obama has recently authorized airstrikes against the militants in Syria, but says he's unwilling to coordinate them with Damascus.
We'll have more on Russia's view of the latest U.S. military action when we speak with Peter Laveau, the host of RT's Crosstalk, later in this newscast. Another one of those U.S. allies has announced that it will not be conducting any airstrikes against ISIL in Syria. France. That, according to the French foreign minister, Laurent Fabius, who said nonetheless that to support the so-called moderate opposition and to fight both the Syrian government and the Islamic State is, quote, a necessity, closed quote, reiterating his country's position that it will continue to support the opposition against Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's government. More than 130,000 refugees have flooded into Turkey from Syria over the past weeks, fleeing attacks by ISIL on their villages, that according to Turkey's deputy prime minister Monday. Local officials in Syria said that Kurdish militias have now blunted the group's advance there. The Security Council took up the issue of the fight against ISIL at its session this past Friday. Nikolai Mladenov of Bulgaria is the UN Secretary General's special representative for Iraq. He reported to the Council on the situation at that session.
It is an honor indeed to brief the Security Council today on behalf of the Secretary General. Mr. President, this is the fourth time that I address the Council on the devastation brought to the people of Iraq by the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. On behalf of the UN mission in Iraq, let me thank the Security Council for its continued interest and its unity in expressing support for the people and the government of Iraq, as well as for making it possible for our mission to fulfill its mandate. Your consistent calls for inclusive political engagement, timely elections, and a government formation process have not gone unheeded. Your condemnation of the violence and the human rights abuses has been welcomed by Iraqis. And finally, your consistent pronouncements, most recently through the adoption of Security Council Resolution 2170, continue to encourage the people of Iraq that they are not alone.
Syria's permanent representative to the UN, Ambassador Bashar Ja'afari, was the last speaker called.
Shukran, Sayyidah Ra'is.
Thank you, Madam President. I'd like to join colleagues who have thanked you for having convened this very important meeting. With the presence of the Minister of Foreign Affairs of the United States, or the Secretary of State, regarding the situation in Iraq, I'm pleased that Mr. Al-Jafari of Iraq is here, as well as that Mr. Mladenov is here. We hope that the Iraqi authorities and the brotherly Iraqi people will make efforts that will lead to success so as to retrieve peace and security across the country and so as to put an end to terrorism and combat it, Madam President. Some speakers went beyond the agenda item under consideration. That is the situation in Iraq. That is what was on the agenda. They spoke about the situation of my country in an erroneous manner and in a very provocative one. In particular, when they talked about the combat against terrorism of what is called ISIL. I was very interested to hear the preliminary statement of Mr. Kerry. In hearing this statement, I did hear balanced wording, one which reflected the importance of the challenge in Iraq and the region. And here I'm talking about terrorism and the threats posed by ISIS and other terrorist organizations in the region. Some other statements, unfortunately, attempted to divert our attention from the crucial issue at hand today. And that is the support to be provided to two governments and two peoples, Iraq and Syria, so as to combat ISIL and Jabhat al-Nusra, as well as other terrorist organizations affiliated with these two terrorist groups. And this, in line with 2170. The war in Syria and Iraq against terrorism is a single war against the same enemy. The victims in both countries are the victims of one terrorism, a heinous one. My country's government is an active participant in combating terrorism against ISIL and Jabhat al-Nusra. We have undertaken these activities unilaterally within Syria over the past 3 years. We always emphasize the importance of counterterrorism, and putting an end to its financing. As well as combating terrorists who come to our country from other countries of the world. We've also stressed the importance of accountability with respect to countries and states who support terrorism. Today, we are extremely relieved as the international community has acknowledged the facts which we have continually transmitted to the Council and to member states within the United Nations. We've always spoken of terrorism, the existence of terrorism, incitation to terrorism. We have stressed those governments supporting terrorism and the media which only supports terrorism. The fatwas, people who claim to be ulemas and who support this terrorism. There are indeed training camps for these terrorists. Some of these camps are in neighboring countries. Moreover, some attempt to mask the identity of those who support terrorism. This international awakening, Madam President, in combating ISIS, and rather ISIL and Jabhat al-Nusra, is a matter of relief, even if it's a late awakening. And thus, we'd like to reaffirm that any international effort in counterterrorism must be based on the full respect of the charter provisions and principles of international law, and in particular, upholding the sovereignty of states. Thus, there's a need to coordinate upstream with the Syrian government in the framework of any credible efforts to combat terrorism. In conclusion, Madam, the combat against ISIL, an effective combat, requires combating its ideologies. Ideologies which are based on the obscurantist Saudi Wahhabite ideology, which was the source of extremism in the Arab and Muslim world. I would like here to recall that there are thousands of Saudi terrorists who joined ISIL in Syria and in Iraq, terrorists who have perpetrated the attack of 11 September, who were, for the majority, Saudis and not Syrians. In addition, the ideas of bin Laden also came from Saudi Arabia. I'd like to reiterate that the events which are shaking the region are the result of collusion between Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and Qatar, which undermines the future of the region. Thank you.
Washington, D.C., like most major cities, is flooded with phone calls and other data on a daily basis. But it appears that much of that traffic, or all of it, is being intercepted by sources unknown. RT's Guyan Chichikayan reports from Washington.
We are in one of the most spied-on cities in the world, Washington, D.C. Here, if you're walking near some powerful building, there's a good chance that your phone is being hacked. A German company came up with a specially outfitted smartphone called CryptoPhone, which can reportedly alert you when there's a surveillance device nearby. The Washington Post took a ride with an executive of the company that promotes the CryptoPhone, and they went to the Russian embassy to test the device.
So here we're driving behind the Russian embassy.
So we got the hit earlier today as we went down this little hill.
Yeah, and we pulled up.
Can we stop here?
Oh, wait a second. You just got hit. So this AT&T phone just got full intercepted. They haven't decided to take over the channel yet, but they've held your ENSI long enough to where the baseband here says you need to be careful.
But it's not just the Russian embassy that triggers alerts in the crypto phone. The company says in less than 2 days of driving through the region, they've detected signs of as many as 18 surveillance devices. They put out a map of the locations. It includes the area around the Supreme Court, where we are at the moment, the Capitol, FBI headquarters, different foreign embassies, a cluster of federal contractors around Dulles International Airport. Those devices are called IMSI catchers. They trick mobile phones into thinking that they've logged on to legitimate cell networks, when in fact, the signals have been hijacked by this fake cell tower. They can be used by pretty much anyone with the right skills. It could be the U.S. government, foreign governments, criminals. Apparently, reasonably skilled hobbyists can build such an IMSI interceptor for less than $1,500.
One of the things they can get is actually what you're saying over the phone, and can also get your identity, so who you are as you're passing by a range of one of these surveillance towers, and they can probably get full access to your phone to the extent that a legitimate cell phone network tower would be able to do, because that's what it's spoofing. It's pretending to be a cell phone company.
While the crypto phone's accuracy may not be 100%, hardly anyone doubts that Washington, D.C. is littered with cell phone data interceptors. And here's, of course, another location that made the crypto phone send alert signals, the White House. And judging by the map of locations where their alert system went off, there's a high probability that it's the U.S. government watching you. But this does not exclude the possibility that private individuals also use the interceptors. In Washington, I'm Ganesh Chagyan, RT.
Russia's warning to the U.S. about military intervention in Syria was one of a number of recent steps the country has taken that seemed to some to reflect bewilderment and deep concern about Washington's plans towards Moscow. Peter Laveau is the host of RT's Crosstalk. We spoke with him Monday about this, about the treatment of Russia in the U.S. media, and more. I was particularly curious to discuss a couple of recent things taking place in and around Russia. The first, a demo that was reported in the New York Times and also at RT that took place in Moscow with an amalgamation of opposition groupings taking place against the what they claim is the Russian role in Ukraine. So we want to talk about that and also your most recent crosstalk talking about the West's perception of Russia, which I think is germane to the first part here.
Well, as far as the demonstration is concerned, I didn't go because I've been to a lot of these demonstrations over the years, and Don, it's always the same people. It's the same people, and they say opposition. Well, these are hardcore Stalinists. These are some are what I would even say almost neo-Nazi in outlook. And then you have the gay rights people. Then you have your run-of-the-mill liberal that just wishes Russia was America. And I can go on and on. It's the same people all the time. So no big deal. The thing what I found really disheartening is that you know, Russia has tried everything in its power to stay out of the conflict in Ukraine, and it's offered ideas to end the civil war there. But this is the usual fifth column in Moscow. It doesn't really raise any eyebrows here. They're, you know, they have the right to organize. To march, and they get police protection. So you know they're exercising their political rights here. And in the second paragraph of whatever the Wall Street Journal or New York Times or Washington Post, Putin's authoritarian society. It's the same old thing. They went out and marched. They had their right to do it. About 26,000 people showed up. That's their usual number.
Right, and it's interesting because. Actually, the law in Russia has become more, even more liberal. And you mentioned that word liberal before, and the terms are kind of elastic when you think of American politics because you have new political parties. Now there's about 80 that have ballot status. It only requires 500 declared members, basically, as opposed to in New York State, you need 50,000 votes to have a ballot line for your governor candidate. And among the top four parties, they list United Russia, which is Putin's party, as being conservative, relatively. But the policies of that government on the spectrum here in the United States, however, would be almost socialist or communist, even compared to some of the so-called socialist parties in Europe. It's just such an elastic term.
Yes, absolutely. As a matter of fact, I've kind of joked, you might have seen it on Facebook, that a liberal in Moscow is basically a Washington neocon. So, yeah, I mean, the terms, they don't work very well. And I think that's the state of our lexicon, our political lexicon, and the way we understand politics and what we expect from the state. I think it's since the Cold War ended, we're in this huge vortex, where you can't hang on to any of these words anymore because they're changing, they're emotive, people make them mean something that they aren't at times. Describing Russian politics can be quite difficult for a Westerner to understand. Putin's party, United Russia, it's statist. I think that's fair to say that there should be a government involvement in the economy, but not overly so. The government doesn't need to plant and grow tomatoes. They've understood that, okay. But when it comes to energy and energy exports, they want to keep an eye on that. Right. When we look at the new laws, it's a bit disappointing because, I remember a few years ago, it was too oppressive. Putin is too oppressive with making so. I think it was 40,000 people had to be signed up to have a party. Now it's 500. But he's still the same bad guy. I mean, make up your mind, okay?
Yeah.
And why should there be so much commentary coming out of Western capitals about Russia's political parties? This is Russia's affair. It has nothing to do with what people in Washington want. The Russians, as I keep telling everyone, ad nauseum, they will go down the path that they choose, and they don't listen to outsiders because there's no reason to.
It's interesting because I worked on two political campaigns here, among others, but two relevant political campaigns in 2004 for Nader and in 2008 for Cynthia McKinney. And in each case, you had national party structures, thousands of people involved as activists within the party, and then an aggregation of hundreds of thousands of votes. And yet, at a minimum, with no press coverage, no being allowed at the debates, nothing, all shut out of all of that. And yet, in New York, you need 50,000 votes in a gubernatorial election in order to have ballot status. In Texas, you have to have 60,000 and change signatures on a petition to get a candidate on the ballot. The United States has a patchwork of these really oppressive and ingenious ways of keeping people off the ballot.
I can address some of the critics when it comes to Russian laws. I can see a point is that the authorities here know that the opposition parties, when they call it systemic and non-systemic parties, people that want to have a party or just a movement, that's non-systemic. But because of the nature of the political culture in Russia, it's full of egomaniacs. Everybody wants to be head of their party. And, by the way, I'm going to be head of the party and everyone else will do the work. This is how the opposition thinks and acts here. It boggles the mind. When I talk to these people, what do you think, if you had a party, what would be the things you'd be interested in doing? Undoing Putin's legacy. Well, why would you want to do that? Why don't you think about schools and hospitals and education and the armed forces and Russia's security? None of those things come to mind. It's always the negative. It's always the negative, and it's always a critique that they borrow from the West. They don't even make up their own.
Let's go back to the elasticity of the terminology. This conservative president, one of the things that he did was reestablish a majority ownership by the government of Gazprom.
Yep.
Which means, basically, if the U.S. government were to nationalize 51% of ExxonMobil or one of those entities, they would be lambasted. Anyone that mentions it in the media is lambasted as being a communist.
If Gazprom were, they had an IPO for all of the shares, then you're going to have huge money from outside the country would buy up Russia's, the very core of its economy. That's a lunacy. That's why there was the intervention on Putin's behalf against Yukos, against Khodorkovsky, because he was going to sell it to a Western company. That is unconscionable. No one would do that in most countries. Why the United States thinks its model of not ownership of energy resources should be good for everyone else. Again, it's this arrogance and it's this sense of being exclusively right in all things, which is nonsense, has nothing to do with the rest of the world. If you look at most energy companies in the world, the vast majority of them are owned or partly owned by the state.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.